These were taken to be signs of election. Now, Calvin did not say that persons who did these things, who were observed doing these things, were among the elect, but he said it might be a sign of God's grace working in them. Now, it's rather interesting that actually the existence of these signs of faith, and then the very nature of the Calvinist communities, produced a kind of a community of compliance. It produced a certain uniformity in behavior. No one wanted to appear not to be among the elect. Now, there's a very interesting way that we can sort of observe this. Yes, we could talk about the ducking stools and the stocks in the village square and so on that we sometimes think of as connected with Calvinist communities, whether in Europe or even in Puritan New England. But if one thinks of portraiture, just for a moment, Renaissance portraits had often been luxurious. People were arrayed beautifully. Women had beautifully coiffed hair and possibly quite beautiful headdresses. Men would be placed or would be painted wearing luxurious, rich, elegant clothing. Men and women might be wearing a considerable amount of jewelry, for example. The setting of the painting would often be sort of either in a verdant countryside or in a castle, in a palace. How many times have you seen those paintings where somebody is painted with a window behind them, sort of looking out into the world? Now, stop and think for a moment of all those paintings you've ever seen of the Dutch masters. Stop and think of the kinds of paintings one gets from sturdy, reformed Europe. Men and women, first of all, typically placed either in no sort of background scenery at all, or else in a domestic scene. The domestic scenes are themselves not luxurious. They're very simple. They're very plain. The people themselves are dressed in black. Their only concession to fashion, perhaps elaborate starched collars. You look at their faces. They are typically expressionless. They also lack a certain color. There's a rather pastiness in the skin. These are serious, stern folk, these reformed people. Now, let's conclude by comparing Luther and Calvin on a few very basic points, just to sharpen in our mind what was similar and what was different. First of all, they agreed on three fundamental points. They agreed on the primacy of Scripture. Though, as we've seen, Calvin placed the sovereignty of God ahead of Scripture, but both agreed on the primacy of Scripture. What that means is Scripture and not the popes, not church councils, not the writings of particular Christian teachers. They both agreed on justification by faith, and faith as a free and undeserved gift of God. They both agreed that free will did not truly exist for humans because of the bondage of sin. Humans were too marked by sin fully to be free. They disagreed on five basic points. Luther did not accept the proposition that grace was persistent and irresistible. Luther didn't accept that. They disagreed on the certitude of salvation. Now, each thought salvation possible in certain circumstances, but they differed on the idea of the certitude of salvation. They differed on the idea of absolute predestination. There is a predestinarian dimension in Luther's thought, yes, but Luther does not hold for absolute predestination as Calvin did. They disagree on the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. Remember, Luther upheld that doctrine while diminishing significantly the role of the priest or the minister in effecting the change from bread and wine to body and blood of Christ. Calvin regarded the Eucharist as symbolic. Finally, they disagreed on the nature of theocratic polity. For Calvin, the church was supreme. For Luther, the state was supreme. Remember Luther's address to the nobility of the German nation, calling on the German princes to reform the church in their territories. Now, it is, to be sure, the case that Calvin's Geneva was a place where the church authorities, the ministers, working through the consistory, for example, had a very important role. Nevertheless, the church and religious authorities were left with final say in Calvin's scheme of things, but not in Luther's. Well, the Reformation then shows us that there will be a variety of forms of religious experience. We see here a deep break in the Western tradition. We see now a fundamental and definitive break with that tradition reaching all the way back to the Greeks that regards humans as essentially good but flawed and capable of becoming better largely through their own work. There is now a comprehensive alternative to that view. We also see that Christendom was riven. But Catholicism will not have, as it were, a single alternative. What one could not well have predicted, let's say at the time of the conclusion of Calvin's reforms, is how many alternatives there would be. Might the reform continue to go on reforming? Well, what we know is that it did, and we'll look at that in our next lecture, but we'll also ask the question that begs itself by now, what on earth was the Catholic Church doing all of this time? To those questions and to further features of the Reformation experience, we'll address ourselves in our next lecture.